We turn our Bibles to the book of Mark, in chapter 2, and we'll consider that passage we read just a few moments ago. I hope you'll forgive me if I talk a little bit more quietly than usual, and my voice seems to be not quite as strong as it was last week after that flu. So hopefully I'll be heard, and hopefully my voice will hold out for the rest of the service. Well, last time we were in the book of Mark, we were considering verses 13 to 22, and we said there that there were two passages which were linked. They were linked by the common theme of eating. Verses 13 to 17 is one passage, verses 18 to 22 is the other, and those two passages were linked then by the subject of eating. Well, this time then, I want us to consider the next two passages, verses 23 to 28, and chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. And I want to suggest, of course, that those two passages are quite obviously linked as well. They're linked by the theme of the Sabbath. And this evening, I just want to consider some of the characters that we encounter in these passages and their relationship then to the Sabbath. So first of all, I want us to consider the enemies of the Sabbath. The enemies of the Sabbath. When I was about 6 years old in primary school, I remember sitting in the dinner hall one day, completely by myself, peacefully in my own world, enjoying a slab of sausage pie. And after I finished my sausage pie, I moved on to my dessert of bananas and custard. And I was enjoying this pudding in splendid isolation, when suddenly I felt a finger pointing at me angrily from a couple of tables away. And I looked up and I saw a girl who I'd never met before, who I never knew, she wasn't my friend, and her eyes were fixed on me with annoyance, and with bitterness in her voice I heard her say these words, "Miss, look, he's eating his pudding with his fork. He's eating his pudding with his fork." And I looked down, and to my horror, I was eating my pudding with my fork. Now, thankfully, I didn't receive detention or exclusion or expulsion for my crime. But for a moment, in my six-year-old brain, I did wonder whether I was about to. It certainly appeared like that's what my accuser was wanting. And there's something of that in this passage, isn't there? Not only the bizarrely petty accusation in verse 24. Look, the disciples are nibbling on bits of corn on the Sabbath day. But also because of the strange way in which the Pharisees just happened to be right there at that time, ready to jump out and make that accusation. You know, it almost feels like Jesus' response should be, "Oh, who are you exactly? Well, what are you doing here?" And you see, having read through accounts like this over the last few weeks, we do get this sensation, don't we, that the Pharisees are kind of stalking Jesus. They always seem to be there, ready to make their accusation. Whether it be the crowds surrounding Simon's house in verses 1 to 12 of chapter 2, or peering through the windows at Levi's house in verses 13 to 22. Or even out in the wheat fields around Capernaum in our passage. These Pharisees' eyes seem to be everywhere. And now they're all fixed on this man, Jesus, and his disciples, looking for things to accuse him about. Now, before we go on, I just want to say a few little things about this accusation that they make of Jesus. Was it the case that Jesus' disciples were breaking any kind of ceremonial Sabbath laws by plucking ears of corn on the Sabbath? Is there a ceremonial law in the Old Testament about not plucking corn? Well, the simple answer is no, there isn't. Harvesting would have been breaking the Sabbath law, but not casually plucking little grain, little ears of wheat, little bits of grain from the field. And in case you're thinking to yourself, well, is there really a clear distinction then between these two things, between harvesting and plucking the grain? Is it fair to draw that kind of distinction between those two things? Well, yes, it is fair. It's a distinction which is actually drawn out in the Old Testament law itself. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 24 clearly says, if you go into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes, as many as you wish, but you shall not put any in your bag. If you go out into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the ears with your hand, but you shall not put a sickle to your neighbor's standing grain. You see, there's the distinction. You can casually take a little bit, but you can't start harvesting. It would be equivalent, perhaps, today for us to be sort of plucking brambles from the hedgerow. And if you think then that a Sabbath law against farm labour necessarily implies a law against eating brambles on the Sabbath, then maybe you'd think the Pharisees have a good case. But in the Old Testament law, there is a clear distinction between those two activities. But of course, the Pharisees had their own elaborate system of Sabbath rules to flesh out what was already in Scripture. And according to their rules, corn plucking was a prohibited activity. And so according to their rules then, Jesus' disciples were engaging in unlawful activity, but not according to the Old Testament law. Okay, so now that we've cleared that, let's ask this question. Why doesn't Jesus just say that? Why doesn't Jesus just point out that distinction and criticize the burdensome laws of the Pharisees? And you know, if we didn't know Jesus any better, we might think that that would be a simple approach for him to take at this point, to explain what the Old Testament law actually says, and then to show how what he was doing and his disciples were doing was actually totally lawful. That seems like a rational approach to go about it. But I think the point is that in Mark's gospel, by this point, we do know Jesus better than that. And we know that Jesus isn't a man whose mission is to defeat the devil through a series of carefully laid out logical propositions. He doesn't adopt a kind of scholastic or rationalist or forensic approach to his critics' objections. It's not his sole aim to defuse their arguments in that way. No, instead, we've come to discover in Mark's gospel a man who is much more profound, much more perceptive than that, much deeper in his response to these kinds of problems. The Jesus that we've become familiar with is one who uses every opportunity to open up the heart of an issue, and to do so then in a way which casts light upon his true identity, upon his true purpose, and upon the true motivations of his critics. And that is what he does here. He doesn't get sidetracked by legal questions about what's right and wrong on the Sabbath. Rather, he plays a little game with his accusers. And this is his game. In response to their objection, he gets them to consider an event from their own history. Verse 25. Have you never read what David did when he was in need and was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar, the high priest, and ate the bread of the presence, which it is not lawful for any but the priests to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him? See, Jesus answers by referring to this story about David. He compares himself to David, and we'll consider all that means in just a moment. But I want to suggest firstly that this story doesn't only cast light on Jesus. Perhaps there's another reason for him to tell this story. I think it actually casts light on these stalking Pharisees. See, notice the story which he tells here. The story which he tells is from 1 Samuel chapter 21, and it's about King David eating the bread of the presence with the priests at Nob. Now the question is this: why did David and his men eat the bread of the presence on that occasion? Why would he even have gone to that unlawful measure in the first place? Well, this is why. because 1 Samuel chapter 21 is the beginning of David's fugitive years. David, King David, is fleeing from a man, King Saul, who wants him dead. And he's eating this bread then because he's on the run. And you see, then this is really, really important to understanding our passage. This is the David that Jesus compares himself to in our passage. It's a David who is being pursued by authorities. It's a David who is hungry and exhausted. A David who will be spending this next long season of his life sleeping in caves and wandering through wildernesses and bouncing from place to place to place. It's a David who needs to stop and eat and even break a ceremonial law because he's in this emergency situation in the first place. And you know, even with those priests in the land of Nob, David would not be safe. Even there, there'd be a pair of eyes watching him take that bread of presence. Doeg the Edomite, hiding in the shadows, who would soon be informing King Saul about what just happened. And on account of him giving him that bread, 85 priests would die at King Saul's command, slain by the sword of Doeg the Edomite. So David is not safe in 1 Samuel chapter 21. He is being relentlessly pursued by men who are thirsty for his life. And this is the point I'm trying to make then. Jesus is comparing himself to the David who will cry out in Psalm 59, "Deliver me from my enemies, O my God. Protect me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from those who work evil and save me from bloodthirsty men. For behold, they lie in wait for my life. Fierce men stir up strife against me. For no transgression or sin of mine, O Lord, for no fault of mine they run and make ready." And you see, while Jesus doesn't make this case explicitly, surely the Pharisees, as they hear Jesus tell this story, would be forced to see the parallel. If Jesus is David in this story, then who are we supposed to be? And so this is the point that I'm trying to get to. Why are these Pharisees stalking Jesus? Do we really think that these Pharisees are stalking Jesus because they're the kind of men who are grieved in their heart of hearts to see the Sabbath profaned? And they're anxious that Jesus and his disciples make the most of their Sabbath rest? Are they really saddened by the sight of men who are refusing to call the Sabbath a delight? Isaiah 58, verse 13. No, that's not what these Pharisees are all about. Let's not kid ourselves about these Pharisees' motivations. These are not men who are truly interested in true Sabbath delight, true Sabbath rest. No, they're men who are vigilant and restless and untiring as Sabbath police, pursuing all those who enjoy true Sabbath rest, making it their duty to prevent these men, Jesus and his disciples, from having a moment's peace and quiet. And it gets worse, doesn't it, in chapter 3. Chapter 3, verses 1 to 6, we see that these are men who even seem to think that a miraculous healing is a contravention of Sabbath rest. That's their argument. And of course, it's not as if miraculous healings were banned in even their Sabbath regulations. You know, as you might expect, the Pharisees had laws against medical practice on a Sabbath day. But even in their own legal codes, there's nothing to ban a miracle of God. So this is pure irrationality on their part. And it's driven then by a groundless fury disguised as a zeal for God's holy law. You know, when we read a few moments ago from chapter 3, verse 4. We read Jesus' question that he asks them in the synagogue after he tells this man with the withered hand to come before him. And Jesus asks the Pharisees this question. He says, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?" Perhaps you hear that question and you think, well, that's a bit of an exaggeration, isn't it? To save life or to kill. I mean, it's not as if this withered hand is a matter of life and death, Jesus. You're putting it in very strong terms there. But you see, this isn't pointless exaggeration for Jesus. These extreme terms are deliberate. And that's because they make the Pharisees' following silence all the more astounding. The fact that these Pharisees are tongue-tied and they can't even commit themselves to the statement that one may do good and save life on the Sabbath is deeply revealing of their true motivations. And of course, on top of all that, Jesus' strong words prepare us for a very dark irony. Talking, of course, about verse 6, the end of our passage. See, these are men, these Pharisees, who apparently believe that healing people is too much work. And yet, these same men immediately find time to leave the synagogue and to plot the destruction of Jesus. Healing, doing good, that's breaking the Sabbath. But immediately plotting destruction, that's fair game. And this is why, then, that I'm calling these men enemies of the Sabbath and not enforcers of the Sabbath. These men aren't Sabbath enforcers, they're Sabbath deprivers. In their supposed zeal for the Sabbath, they drain the Sabbath of all possible goodness, all peace, all rest, and all they do is replace it with tireless stalking and plotting and destroying. And I would challenge you again this evening. I hope this doesn't characterize what your Christianity looks like today. I hope these aren't your attitudes towards Christian things. You know, we should remind ourselves, shouldn't we, that legalism and hypocrisy didn't die with the Pharisees. It's not something that we find today only locked up in other religions like Islam or Judaism or whatever else it might be. No, it lurks in the very best of us, even in this day and age. There are Christians out there who truly believe that Christianity is at its purest and its best when it's not being enjoyed. That holiness has reached its peak when it demands you to run into the ground and exhausts you, as if exhaustion is the Christian ideal. And it disturbs these people then to see too much smiling over serious Christian matters. Well, don't be that kind of Pharisaical Christian. If there's anything in the attitude of these Pharisees which disturbs you, then likewise be disturbed at your own inner Pharisee, which lives in us all. And whenever then a legalistic or a hypocritical or an accusative spirit rises up within us that reflects anything of these Pharisees and finds its comfort in a miserable self-made religion, then let's put that down. It might look like an attitude of zeal and fervour for true Christianity, but it may actually be the real enemy of true Christianity. So we've considered then the enemies of the Sabbath. Secondly, let us consider the Lord of the Sabbath. The Lord of the Sabbath. Because you see, there's another side to this story about David and his men. Pharisees might have been those restless authorities hunting down their prey, but what about Jesus? Well, Jesus, of course, is David. And why is that significant in our passage? Well, it's significant because it takes us to the centre of Jesus' argument about the plucking of the wheat. The point is that David, on that day back in 1 Samuel chapter 21, did something which was ceremonially unlawful. He ate the bread of the presence, which normally would be only eaten by the priests. And yet at the same time, in doing that, in eating that bread, we're told that David does something which is totally appropriate given the circumstances. And why is that? Well, it was appropriate not only because he was in an emergency, but also because of his special entitlements, because he was King David. He could do it because he was the king, because he was King David. Now, I don't want to get deep into the question of why David had those special entitlements, but I at least want us to see the logic of Jesus' argument here. The logic is this, that even if Jesus and his disciples were breaking some ceremonial or civil law about the Sabbath, and they weren't doing that. But even if they were, what would it matter anyway? I mean, if King David and his men could bend a law due to his special status and do that which was not lawful, then surely King Jesus and his men could do that as well. In short, if David can break the law, so too can Jesus. Now, of course, maybe we scratch our heads a little bit at that. And we think, well, hang on a second, that doesn't quite add up, does it? I mean, surely something would be amiss if Jesus just broke whatever moral law he decided to. If he just murdered someone, or lied, or dishonored his parents. Why would it be any different with ceremonial Sabbath laws? Well, to answer that question, I want us just to briefly consider the Jewish Sabbath. Just get to the heart of the matter of what the Sabbath was. I mean, remember, the Sabbath wasn't just a Saturday off. And it wasn't just dealt with in the fourth commandment. Rather, the Sabbath was a principle of rest which was ingrained into the whole Jewish calendar and the whole ceremonial and civil legal system. Society as a whole, the seven annual festivals, the land and the livestock, all of these things were shaped around the Sabbaths. Leviticus chapter 25 tells us that every seventh year there was meant to be a Sabbath year in Israel, a year in which the land itself would rest and not be cultivated. More than that, Deuteronomy chapter 15 tells us that in that year, debts were meant to be cancelled and servants were meant to be released. So why then was this elaborate system? Well, it was there because there was this deep principle of rest that God wanted Israel as a society, as a nation, to heed. As the Ten Commandments said, "For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy." You see, to honour the Sabbath was to follow the pattern of God himself and to participate in the rest of God himself. More than this, in particular, the Sabbath was a memorial of the rest that God had given his people in releasing them from the Egyptian captivity, from their slave drivers in Egypt. Deuteronomy chapter 5 verse 15 tells us, "You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." You see, Sabbath rest was a gift from God. It was a command to participate in the rest and the pleasure and the peace of God that he himself had enjoyed at the completion of creation. And it was a command to enjoy the peace and the pleasure and the rest of being free from enemy captivity. And then, the elaborate, the civil ceremonial legal system then that's given in the Old Testament, well, that was the best way for Israelite society to shape itself around that principle, to benefit from it, to reflect upon the gracious gift that God had given them. Now, to be clear, if Jesus had profaned that sacred principle of rest, that would be wrong. For him to act in a way that contradicted the heart of the Sabbath, for him to impose work on God-instituted rest, and for him to expend his energies when his God had told him to stop, of course that would all be sinful. For him to think lowly about the good rest of God at the completion of creation, or for him to despise the rest that God had given his children from their enemies and their captivity, well, that would have been totally unacceptable for Jesus. Jesus was constrained by the fourth commandment no less than anybody else was. But that didn't mean that the Sabbath system, as embodied in the Old Testament ceremonial law, was some law over Jesus' head, some legal lord that Jesus had to submit to in whatever the circumstance. Why is that? Well, that's because the Sabbath wasn't lord over Jesus. No, as verse 28 in our passage tells us, "So the Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath. See, Jesus possesses an office and an identity that means he calls the shots as far as the Sabbath is concerned. So the Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath. I don't want to say too much about that phrase, the Son of Man, now. We've spoken about it briefly already in a previous sermon. We said a few weeks ago how that phrase, Son of Man, probably refers to the glorious godlike figure that we encounter in Daniel chapter 7, who's presented there with this everlasting kingdom and who's given all dominion and all authority. And as we read earlier on in chapter 2, verse 10, we learnt there that this Son of Man has also been given the authority to forgive sins. And here then, in our passage, we learn that this same Son of Man, Jesus Christ himself, has authority over the Sabbath. He calls the shots because of his authoritative office as the Son of Man. But I think there's perhaps an even more striking word in that verse, verse 28. And it's just a four-letter word in English, and it's that word Lord. So the Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath. And at this point in the sermon, I'm grateful that I was off last week with a cough, because it meant that Dan could speak at length about that idea of that the use of the word Lord in the New Testament, that Greek word kurios. And the significant thing about it, of course, is that's the same Greek word which the translators of the Old Testament into Greek had used to when they were using the name of God Yahweh. So that's the Hebrew word Yahweh had been translated kurios, Lord, into the Greek. And so then when the New Testament writers used that word, they had all of that baggage in their minds. This wasn't just Lord in a generic masterly sense. No, it had all that connotation of Godhood behind it. And it's particularly striking in this book of Mark, because this is only the second time in the book which Mark has actually used that word Lord. The first time he used the word was back in chapter 1, verse 3, when he was quoting from the Old Testament prophets, prepare the way of the Lord, prepare the way of Yahweh. But you know, even without all of these arguments over Greek and Hebrew words, Jesus still couldn't be plainer about his point here. Because how does the Old Testament frequently refer to the Sabbath of God? Well, it refers to it like that, the Sabbath of God. Very frequently, it's referred to as the Sabbath to the Lord, to Yahweh. That's the language of the Ten Commandments, the Sabbath to Yahweh. Or again, we read of how frequently God so often refers to the Sabbath as my Sabbaths. So Exodus chapter 31, verse 13, you shall keep my Sabbaths. Or Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 13, my Sabbaths they greatly profaned. And here then we have Jesus, and he's in this field of wheat. And here are these Pharisees, and they're mourning that Jesus is a Sabbath breaker. And what does he do? Well, essentially, he stares the Pharisees in the eyes. And he stares at them in the face of all their supposed Sabbath regulations. And he plucks up an ear of wheat, and he says, my Sabbath. The Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath. See, this is Jesus' point. All that the Sabbath is, all that it gets its essence and force from, is Jesus himself. Which means that even the ceremonial law, perfect though it was for Israel at that time in history, even that doesn't get to make demands of Jesus. The Sabbath isn't some force outside of Jesus which may impose upon him whatever it wants. No, the Sabbath law humbly takes its humble position. It bows before Jesus in the midst of the lawgiver. In fact, Jesus doesn't just give the Sabbath law, because even then you might think it would have some sort of force exterior to him. No, the Sabbath emerges from him. It perfectly reflects him in all of his ways. And so you see then the person who's standing in this field of wheat, plucking ears of corn. That's the same man who on the seventh day of the creation week, the same person who on the seventh day of the creation week, after creating the entire universe, even creating the intricacies of wheat itself, rested and took pleasure in all that he had done. Jesus instituted the first Sabbath ever. And the person then standing in this field of wheat was the same person who guided those Israelites out of Egypt, out of their captivity, and into the rest of the promised land, who gave them that great Sabbath rest in Israel all of those years ago. You know, the reason those Pharisees were standing here in this fertile field of wheat was because their forefathers had been brought out of the dry land of Egypt and into a promised land to rest there, and they'd been brought there by Yahweh, the great I Am, the great one who Jesus is now claiming so clearly to be. So you see then that we're encountering here not a mere man, we're encountering the Lord of the Sabbath, one who gives the Sabbath all of its character, and from whom the Sabbath has its very identity and its essence. He isn't a subject of the Sabbath. He is a Lord of the Sabbath. So we've considered then this evening the enemies of the Sabbath and the Lord of the Sabbath. But thirdly and finally, I want us to consider the partakers of the Sabbath. The partakers of the Sabbath. The beginning of chapter 3, when Jesus enters this synagogue, it almost looks at first sight like Jesus has entered a trap, doesn't it? Jesus enters the synagogue, and there the Pharisees are, and they're watching him again. And this man with the withered hand happens to be there, and these Pharisees are thinking, this is excellent. Will he heal this man with the withered hand on the Sabbath? Will he take the bait and give us grounds to accuse him? This is just what we're after. Jesus has entered a trap. The fact is, of course, that you can never trap Jesus. And even when the Pharisees look like they've left him no room for escape, he only has to say a few words before everything is reversed, and they are the ones trapped and wriggling. And so he calls over the man with the withered hand, and then he asks him a question. And within a few moments then, he has locked the Pharisees into silence and exposed their true hearts and their true motivations. And what does he ask the man with the withered hand? Well, he asks, is it lawful? What does he ask the Pharisees? He asks, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm? To save life or to kill? And there's silence. And he looks around the room and nothing. And he's grieved. And he's angry. It's just an aside. Isn't there something which is so deeply moving and reassuring and comforting to see Jesus so outraged at the silence of these Pharisees in verse 5? And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart. You know, anger is not always a frightening thing, is it? Sometimes when it's anger on your behalf, it can be a deeply stirring thing. Especially when that person offers you not just their anger, but all of their strength and all of their authority. Notice how Jesus has anger and grief. It's the grief which underlies the anger, isn't it? He's grieved because these men can't even commit themselves to wishing for the good health of this sick man. And so obviously then this grief leads to anger. It leads to him putting his foot down. And in a sense then it's the anger actually which reveals itself in the healing of this man. This is a healing of judgment upon their own heads as they're forced to reflect upon their own mercilessness. We couldn't even approve of this healing, they're forced to ask themselves. And you know then, these emotions of grief and anger, these are the emotions which stir in the divine heart when God looks down upon us and he sees the world and the devil wishing our harm today. You know, there are forces in this world which are not silent on the matter of your welfare. No, Satan would rather you were dead than alive. He would rather you were harmed than benefited. He'd rather you struggle than grow. Satan throws temptations at you not to refine you by fire, but that you might be burnt to death by the fire. Satan doesn't want you to enter the presence of Jesus purified from your sin. He wants you to reject Jesus and to lose him. And Jesus then, as he looks upon that, and he looks around the cosmos, and he sees the demons, and he sees the haters of his people, he is filled with grief and anger. And he puts his foot down, and he rises up with an air of defiance and justice, and ultimately deep, deep love for his people. And he heals us. So find comfort in that grief and anger of God on your behalf. The anger of God here is not your enemy, it's your friend. But you know, there is another way of talking about Jesus' strong emotions here in this passage, and it might surprise us. I want to say that Jesus is grieved here in this passage and angry out of his zeal for the Sabbath. Why do I say that? Well, I say that because Jesus doesn't just observe an apathetic attitude towards good and evil in these Pharisees. He doesn't just see them sort of with overly fussy attitude towards the Sabbath and get angry because of that. No, more particularly, he's witnessing them as enemies of the Sabbath. And I mean this. Here in this passage, we witness the Lord of the Sabbath angered by these enemies of the Sabbath who would wish to deprive a sick man not just of healing, but of pure Sabbath rest. I mean that in this passage, I think Jesus reveals to us once again that the Sabbath isn't merely a law or a system of laws, it's a gift from God to man. Verse 27 of chapter 2. And he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And it's that gift then that finds its ultimate fulfillment in a rest, not merely from work, not merely from Egyptian slavery, but from the slavery of the curse even more generally than that. You see, true Sabbath rest means rest from sickness and disease and all of the consequences of the curse across the worlds. And it's this true Sabbath rest then that the Pharisees have no care in the world for. For as far as they see, the Sabbath is just a legal code. They've lost sight of the promise, the goodness, which lies behind that code. And there always was a promise, wasn't there? Indeed, every Sabbath when Israel rested and they considered their deliverance into the promised land, they would have to ponder their future. They'd have to ponder the words, as Hebrews chapter 4 puts it. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. There remained a rest. There was a deeper Sabbath behind all of the legal codes. And this man then experiences something of that deep Sabbath rest here. And you know, such a rest would be far more comprehensive than anything we can really imagine today. It will be a rest which means that for those of us who partake in it will be the end of every affliction, every pain, every disease, because the Sabbath rest Jesus brings is the rest for the whole of creation. And to demonstrate then this principle of Sabbath rest in this passage, Jesus tells this man to stretch out his hand. And gradually then this paralyzed and gnarled and contorted hand softens and grows and becomes mobile and supple and healthy and strong. And in that moment, it's a moment of pleasure and relief and release for this man in the synagogue. And he becomes something of a partaker in the true Sabbath of God. And as I said then, that this sight of healing, in a way that baffles us, it disturbs the Pharisees. You know, this healing, we would think it's the most wonderful thing they've ever seen. It's the closest encounter they've had to a miracle of God, surely. They're seeing something even more spectacular than many of the Old Testament saints had seen. And yet, what's their response? Well, their response is to immediately leave the room and plot with the Herodians to destroy Jesus. And by doing so, they make it clear that they really have no desire at all to partake of the true Sabbath that they claim to revere so highly. But for us, we witness something of our gift from God in that healing, the beginnings of a worldwide rest which we will one day partake of. You know, that little hand coming to life is like a picture of this whole world coming back into a state of goodness and health and peace and rest. As you see those knuckles unfolding and the fingers growing and the bones straightening themselves out and the nerves coming back to life again and the muscles unstiffening and the whole hand taking health and vigour back again. And gradually the whole liberation flowing through that man. We're seeing a force which one day will flow through the whole of this world and every part of this world and every part of our bodies, lifting the toil and the captivity and the restlessness off this world and releasing it from its bondage and its stress and its ruthless labour, the chains being broken and a full Sabbath peace resuming once again. Perhaps this evening that seems like very far away for you. Perhaps you're tired and you're stressed and you're wanting release and relief this evening from your own burdens and your own toils and your own restlessness. Well, I would just encourage you to look into this passage and to see then that there is a deep promise of Sabbath rest, which is absolutely sure. And I would encourage you then to look forward to it, to strain towards it, to pray for it, to trust that promise, and to understand that one day you will be a partaker in this great Sabbath rest. But don't lose hope. It's promised for you. It's promised all throughout Scripture, and it's promised in this passage. Let's thank God that He has confirmed this for us, that He has sealed this inheritance for us, that He has promised there will be a day when we will enjoy a rest for the people of God, which still remains, but that we'll one day be able to partake in fully. Amen.